You are listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. Views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au.
The reading is from Although, of Course, You End Up Becoming Yourself by David Foster Wallace. And I remember just being real impatient with love songs. I realized that what if you just imagine that this absent lover they're singing to is just a metaphor? And what they're really singing to is themselves or to God. Since you left me, I'm so empty, I can't live, my life has no meaning. In a weird way, love songs are incredibly existentialist. They have a patina of the romantic just to make it saleable. But all of the pathos and heart that comes out of them is they're singing about something much more elemental being missing, and they're being incomplete without it, rather than just some girl. The real problem is the discontented self. Think of times in your life that you've treated people with extraordinary decency and love and pure uninterested concern just because they were valuable human beings. We have the ability to do that with ourselves. To treat ourselves the way we would treat a really good, precious friend or a tiny child of ours we loved more than life itself. I think part of the job we're here for is to learn how to do that.
Thanks, Michael. The English language we think in structures the way we express and share our thoughts and feelings. English is a complex and hybrid language, full of variety, and they tell me it's one of the hardest to learn. I'm grateful because I've never had to learn it. Well, not that I remember. In sound, it's a genetic mix of percussive Germanic, full of hard consonants, and the melodic Latin, full of soft flowing vowels. English is a love child born of crossbreeding. It's thus a very rich language as languages go. English has a word for every nuance of thought and feeling. But in talking of love, our English language is poor indeed. And maybe that's why Anglos are so typically bad at it. If words were workers, the word love would be applying for stress leave. It does so much multitasking. Mostly the word love in our Anglo culture has come to mean romantic love, and there are, only a quadrillion or so love songs and poems that use the word love in this way, as the reading reminds us. But the word love also appears in religious and spiritual contexts too, you know, love of neighbor, love of God, love your enemies. Now these are really different uses of the word, but the cultural dominance of the romantic meaning of love means that talking about love in church can make church culture feel a little creepy. Love one another doesn't mean you should ply your way into each other's hearts and boudoirs with dinner dates and flowers. And if we think about it even a little, we expect the word love to cover all sorts of kinds of affection. I mean, when I say I love my wife, it doesn't mean the same thing as when I say I love my daughters. Or when I say, I love you, my congregation, is when I say, I love a gin and tonic. So in a church context, what we mean when we talk about love is very different from these more commonplace uses of the word. Take this hymn, for example. Love in this hymn aspires to something a lot grander than family or friendships or freaking Tinder. stand as you're able. The word love in this context doesn't mean love as we commonly use it. English only has one word to cover a wide range of affectionate feeling. Other languages have more. Attic Greek had no less than 4 different words for different types of love. You can see them on the screen. The most familiar of these is the most primal. Eros. Erotic love has always been heavily overrepresented in popular music. As the reading indicated, Eros is physical, passionate, romantic love with sensual desire. It's pure emotion and therefore utterly irrational. It's all about a hunt, like tawny, scrawny lion, to satisfy a hunger. But Eros is not necessarily a bad thing. Plato said that Eros is actually the body trying to remind the soul of its love for the beauty of the eternal from whence it came. And so Eros actually grows our spirituality, suggesting that even sensual love aspires to a higher spiritual plane, as does things like the Kama Sutra. You must be familiar with this. This connection between the physical and the spiritual is perhaps why an erotic love poem is included in the Bible. It opens like a Barry White song. Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for thy love is better than wine. It's the Song of Solomon from the Old Testament, an erotic love poem. Quite pornographic in parts, in fact. You should check it out. Scholars view this as a metaphor for the spiritual love of God for earthly and fleshed humanity and fleshly humanity's love for its source of being. So Eros is one type. Philia is more of a mental state. It means positive, affectionate regard. See, I'm down with the kids. I know about the Friends series. Positive affectionate regard. It's a more dispassionate, virtuous love shown by the virtues of loyalty to friends and community, and assumes equality and familiarity, which Eros doesn't necessarily. But philia can also refer to an affection for an activity, a fondness for an activity. So philosophy, love of wisdom. Philanthropy, love of humanity. Philatelics, love of stamp collecting. Very different from Eros, because you can't eroticize things like wisdom or stamp collecting or humanity, or can you? I'm sure there's a fetish website out there somewhere for each of these. A wholly different kind of love in Attic Greek is the natural affection felt by parents for offspring, called storge. Storge, familial love. This was used to describe affection within the family. And lullabies, like the one we've just heard, is a familiar musical expression of that kind of love. And for many people, storge, that love is more powerful and more meaningful than any erotic or friendship attachment. So these are the 3 so-called natural loves, Eros, Philia, and Storge, and they're familiar enough and obviously different, and they can combine to produce lots of different nuances of meanings when we use the word love. So when I say, I love my wife, there's elements of all 3, Eros, Philia, because, you know, we have friendship, and Storge, because she's family. When I say, I love my daughters, Philia and Storge. When I say, I'd love another gin and tonic, it's Philia. Maybe a little Eros if I get lucky. But perhaps the most... There's no such thing as a cheap laugh in this church, I tell you. But perhaps the most difficult kind of love, the most difficult kind of love for us to comprehend, much less live, is the 4th Attic Greek word, agape. Agape means love in a purely spiritual sense, unconditional positive regard, self-sacrificing, seeking nothing for itself, giving your best to someone despite how you feel about them, despite your relationship to them. So in phrases like love your neighbor, love your enemies as you love yourself, agape is the word used there. And throughout the Greek New Testament, most memorably in Paul's letter known as the love chapter, 1 Corinthians 13, you know the one, love is patient. Love is kind. It does not envy. It does not boast. It is not proud. It does not dishonor others. It is not self-seeking. It is not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongs. A little Rolodex of times people have injured you. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. Imagine a love that only gives and expects nothing in return. Agape was used to express the unconditional love of the Creator God for his human creation, but agape is not exclusive to divine beings. Agape is an underused potential in human beings as well, modeled in Christian theology on the entirely human Jesus, who demonstrated by both his life and his suffering and his death the higher love greater than which no one hath. So all these three natural loves, eros, philia, and storge, aspire to and point toward this higher, more perfect agape love. And perhaps that's why the natural loves are so common in songs. Music heightens our all-too-human earthbound language, and this is probably, too, why singing has always been central to worship. It lifts the spirit of love to a higher plane. Thank you again, by the way, Tara Singers, for doing this for us today. So is agape worth aspiring to? Can't we just make do with the natural loves? Well, consider that each of these three natural loves, eros, philia, and storge, have significant natural dark sides. Eros is almost entirely a physical drive and therefore amoral, and can urge lovers to evil as well as to good. I mean, think of sexual jealousy, or possessiveness, or obsession, or indiscriminate lust, you know, wanting a lover rather than a particular lover. These are some of Eros's darker manifestations. Philia's downside can be seen when friendship becomes exclusive and tribal, as in-groups and cliques. And Storge's very apparent naturalness can make it hard for children to grow up, individuate, and become autonomous. And in parents, storge can easily become smothering and overparenting. So agape is very different from these natural loves. That doesn't mean it's supernatural exactly, but it's a sort of love that has no dark side, a love that has the faith and the hope to relinquish the self. How might we undertake to have an experience of this kind of love? Is it only in our imaginations? Is it only in ancient texts? Is it only for theists? And if we can't even imagine such love, what prevents us? I think a clue to that challenge of acquiring a sense of this is suggested by the reading. The author notes that the prevalence of "I love you" lyrics in popular music looks suspiciously like someone trying to fill a hole in themselves by stuffing another person into it. Think about it. How many people in your life have you said, "I love you" to, and really meant, "I need you," or "I am incomplete without you"? Like tawny, scrawny lion's hunger, a sense of personal incompleteness, to whatever degree we have it, discourages self-giving, discourages agape. This discontent stems from, I mean, we get it naturally, the incomplete self, the discontented self. It stems naturally from an uncomfortable truth about our existence we would sooner forget. And that is that we are, all of us, solitudes. We pass into and out of this world utterly alone. And between those two absolutely solitary thresholds, we experience life from our own single monofocal perspective, and do so among lots of other solitudes. Now, to use other solitudes as spare parts to fill a hole in ourself diminishes both the lover and the beloved. Our first Unitarian principle reminds us that all people have inherent worth and dignity, and thus we are called to regard the other with the same worth and dignity as we would regard ourselves. Agape may be thought of as what we experience in this right relationship, when our boundaries, the boundaries of our solitudes, best connect with those of others. When we get this relationality right, we may experience an expansion of self, which some have called a religious experience. We become bigger than us. Some point to that as the presence of the divine. It's certainly evidence of agape. When progressive theologians say that God is relational, this is what they mean. The German poet Rainer Maria Rilke defined this sort of right relationship to others as this: love consists in this, that two solitudes protect and touch and greet each other. Now, to do that contacting and protecting and greeting, to form right loving relationships with other solitudes, we must first be okay in our own solitude. If we feel incomplete in ourselves, we will find the more we give. If we feel complete in ourselves, we will find the more we give, the more we have. If we don't feel complete in ourselves, we always risk either a really crippling existential loneliness, which there is an epidemic in the world at the moment, and loneliness is not the same as solitude. Or, if we don't feel complete in ourselves, we risk clumsily crashing past other people's boundaries to possess them in an attempt to make us feel less solitary. So, self-love is ironically the most humble love. With healthy self-love, your solitude can never overwhelm you and make you a perpetual need machine. Self-love makes all forms of love better, makes eros better, makes philia better, it makes storge better, and self-love is the only thing that can make unconditional agape, self-giving love possible. Rabbi Hillel puts it like this: if I am not for myself, then who will be for me? And if I am only for myself, then what am I? But you know, loving yourself is harder than you'd think, isn't it? Because so much of our culture conspires to teach us to loathe ourselves. And so we get a world of discontented, incomplete self, singing the blues, searching in utterly the wrong direction, outward for fulfillment rather than inward. Yes, of course, there is danger in taking self-love to excess. It can turn malignant, it can morph into self-indulgence and vanity and narcissism. But as a mid-career minister now, my experience as a minister of seekers is that it is far more likely that people will not love themselves enough and are far more likely to see worth and dignity in every other person and not include themselves for fear of seeming self-centered. And so we get thousands of cultural messages like this every day. Why? Well, the discontented, hungry, tawny, scrawny, needy self can be profited from. It's too easy to reinforce personal worthlessness and suggest it's relievable by purchasing something that will make us more desirable. This, by the way, is how consumerism rots the soul and poisons human relationships. Learning to love, to be in right relationship to all others, your neighbors, even your enemies, is the ultimate moral aim of all religion. And if it were easy, everybody would be doing it, but it's not, and they obviously aren't. But if we would aspire, you and me, to become more loving, and therefore more lovable, no less is required of you that you do value your own inherent worth and dignity, and in freeing yourself from the need for affirmation from others, you find you can love others with all your heart, all your mind, all your soul, and not be diminished. Agape, love divine, all loves excelling. And you are worth that aspiration. Yes, you are. And the world needs you to aspire to this. Do you want proof that you were born inherently precious and worthy and thus capable of agape love? Would you? Rational proof? Okay. You talked me into it. Each one of you here today is the result of a single sperm and a single egg, right? And you are aware that every single sperm and every single egg each have their own unique DNA, right? And only one combination of that unique sperm and that unique egg could have created the you that you are. I'll skip the math. But given how many sperm cells an average male and how many eggs an average female produces in a lifetime, your chances of being at all are not 1 in 180 million. They're not 1 in 180 billion. They're not 1 in 180 trillion. The chances of your being at all is 180 quadrillion to one. And remember, those would be the same odds faced by every one of your ancestors, and only that unique combination of them could have produced the unique as a snowflake you. All of us living witness to the power of Eros. No wonder the Greeks regarded that primal force of sexual procreative love a mighty god. You have not only won this heavenly lottery, but billions of consecutive lotteries with nearly impossible odds. Your chance at life is so infinitely small, but you've won the greatest jackpot any lottery could ever give you. You've been given a whole unique human life. What's better than that? A new Merc? And let's face it, you've been given a pretty privileged life at that. Thy life's a miracle. And so is everyone's. So why not love and cherish and grant worth and dignity to your once in an eternity completely unique and privileged self already? Love is not out there waiting in someone else to be hunted down and captured. It's already inside you. In you is the portal to agape, love divine. And perhaps this is what Jesus meant when he said, the kingdom of heaven is within you. Within you. Do you know who else it's in? It's in the person sitting next to you in the pew. Do you know who else it's in? It's in your neighbor that you don't speak to, except maybe a grunt when you find yourselves taking the trash cans out at the same time. Do you know who else it's in? It's in each and every one of the asylum seekers whom we treat worse than livestock and for whom we stand up today. Love starts with you, but you are only the start. Because what really matters is not that you have a fortune, but what you do with it. A fortune is worthless. A fortune's only numbers. Unless it's spent. And what we mean when we use the word love in church is not love at all. When we cling and hoard and withhold, doling it out in dribs and drabs only to family or a few selected friends or our lovers. But love is agape only when it is scattered like seed, expended joyously to all. That generous spiritual maturity is our aspiration when we talk of love. Spiritual maturity is not about how smart you are. It's not about how many languages you speak. It's not about how many pretty words you know. Spiritual maturity is about how abundantly and how well you love. Full stop. Period. Cut and dried. That is it. And if agape love, love divine, seems like a pie in the sky ideal or just some corny love song, I tell you, love divine lives within you and in every human heart, waiting to be expressed, expended, shared. Just as your one precious life, lay dormant like a seed in the soil of eternity, waiting for the fires of Eros to bring it into full flowering being. Dante called this love the love that moves the sun and the other stars. And that love can change the world because it already has, because from all eternity and from out all possibility, you are here. Amen.
Well, we hope you enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter and the podcast used in its entirety. This permission can be obtained by emailing unitarianessay@bigpond.com. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching Essay Unitarians.